Okay, so I want to continue with the seven. We made a start last time, and we will finish it today. Move on to book eight next time, tomorrow, Wednesday. And I should probably remind you that you have papers coming up in the not too distant future. Don't you? Major course papers, right? When do they do?
18th.
Yeah, that's the not too distant future. You've forgotten about that, so it's good that I remind you. It's more fun ahead. All right. I am working on the midterms. I hope to have them back soon. Maybe Wednesday. We'll see. I'll let you go. All right. Questions or comments about what we talked about last time? I did talk about the midterm question, the essay, and what I realized is that some of you are having trouble picking out arguments, so I want to spend a little bit more time with that. We started to do it on Wednesday, on last Wednesday, last week, and we didn't get very far. So, just to review here, we started to do book 7 of physics, and the first sentence of book 7 is everything that's in motion must be moved by something. And we figured out that, what do we say about that sentence? It's the conclusion of an argument that follows. And the next paragraph is an argument for that conclusion. And then we looked at the beginning of chapter 2, that which is the first mover of a thing is always together with that which is moved by it. And that turned out to be another conclusion. So there has to be some, everything that's moved has to have a mover, and the mover and the moved have to be together or in contact. And what we noticed was, if that's the case, there's no action at a distance. And Newton's wrong. And consequently, everyone gave up Newtonian physics at the end of the last class and has adopted Aristotelian physics.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, the idea, the claim here is if the mover and the moved have to be in contact, first of all, there are different kinds of motion. What we need to do in order to prove this is to help prove that it holds for all the different kinds of motions. And what we said at the end of the last class, or maybe it wasn't at the beginning, sometime in the last class, was if it's the case that the mover and moved have to be into contact, have to be in contact, then there has to be some motion prior to a mover's and a moved, a mover's causing a moved to move. And that motion has to be what kind of motion? Local motion. It has to move from one. There has to be something to get the mover and the moved together. I've got the fire, I've got the paper, I've got to light the match, I've got the paper. The paper does not ignite until the match comes into contact, or at least close enough to the paper that it starts burning. Has to be some local motion that will get mover and moved together. So local motion seems to be the primary motion. And this is important for us, for the end of the physics, because we're interested in the first cause of motion. Hello, nice to have you here. Okay. We started looking at an argument closely in the first chapter. Everything that's in motion must be moved by something is the conclusion. And could somebody just remind me of what we looked at before? So it's been a long and wild weekend for me. I don't know about you. David.
If motion is moved by something, if it cannot move itself, something else must move it.
Okay, so we have two possibilities. Either it moves itself or it's moved by something else. Right? If it's moved by something else, then obviously that would be it. The conclusion holds. The Problem is the thing that's moved by itself, right? Because that seems to be something that's not moved by something else. All right, so how's he going to prove that something that moves itself is actually moved by something else? Tough one, right? You want to continue? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You cannot move without a cause, and then something that moves as a whole, i.e. continuous things, don't move themselves because of that whole, right, they're touching.
Something that moves itself that's continuous doesn't move itself. Is that what you're saying?
There's something that moves as a whole.
Something that moves as a whole, which is the way continuous things move, are interested and move all together. That's why they're continuous. At least that was a definition of continuous that we had in Bokioda. Understanding of continuous in physics is different. It has to do with infinite divisibility. But nonetheless, continuous things move as a whole. What happens when they move themselves? Isn't it obvious they're not moved by something else? Seem to have a counterexample to Aristotle's conclusion. Dwayne, can you help us out? Didn't we talk about this last time?
The internal locomotion. One passage is moving, another has been moving.
All right, the claim is that it could be the case that one part of the thing is moving the other. How come?
That part of it didn't really grasp. I didn't really grasp how one part of it is moving the other, and that allows the whole to move. Because if a part of it is a part of it, then isn't that the whole moving itself?
Yeah, sounds like it to me. What's going on here? All right, things are either moved by other things or by themselves. In both cases, the claim is everything that's moved is moved by something else. Okay, so how can it be that something that moves itself is really moved by something else? Wayne gave us an answer. Part of the thing is moving it. Okay, how can we show that whenever something moves as a whole, part of the thing is moving it? It's kind of a funny argument. We talked about this last time. Would you imagine something that's moving? This is a thing. Okay. Moving as a whole, so it's continuous. Okay. Now what? Where do we go from here? Okay. Now what? I think he calls it KM.
AC moves CD.
I'm sorry.
AC is supposed to move CD. But the whole thing. So AB is in motion.
AB is in motion. We know that. And we divide it into AC here. So what can we say here? They're both moving, because the whole thing is moving. All right, let's look at it carefully. We did this already, but here we are, 408 in this edition, 242A, I guess, around, no, I see, 242. It's 241B around 40. So in the first place, to assume, okay, maybe I'll go back to it here. Okay. So let A, B here be taken to represent that which is in motion of itself and not in virtue of the fact that something is belonging to it in motion. Now, in the first place, to assume that A, B, because it is in motion as a whole, is not moved by anything external to itself, is therefore moved by itself. This is just as if supposing that K, L is moving L, M, and is itself in motion, we were to deny that KM is moved by anything on the ground that it's not evident which is the part that is moved. That's the first step, as much as we need last time. Somebody translate that. Tell us what it means.
AC, in this case, like AC would be the mover, CP would be the mover.
Yeah.
And because of that interaction, AD is moving.
Because of what?
That interaction between AC and CB, AB is moving.
Okay, so the whole thing is moved, and AC is somehow moving CB.
How does this work with like a concrete example? It would be like AC is the brace and then the same length of the legs. And CB would be the legs and AB would be like the human.
Okay.
Is that how this works?
I think so. So what can we say here? The whole is moving altogether. But in this case, in our case, we have a pretty good idea that it's our brain that's moving our legs, rather than our legs that's moving our brain. In this case, we don't quite know which one it is. So his claim is that if we don't know which one it is, we don't have any basis to deny that there's one part that's moving the others. There's no, just because we don't know which part is moving the other parts, there's no ground to deny that there is some one part that's moving the other parts. Of course, that's not the argument yet. It's only the first claim. Okay? So,
the question that we have about the immaterial moving to material, it's not possible, right? So in a case like our mind moving or our body, it's not supposed to be possible.
Yeah, it doesn't happen. Really. Not according to this argument. So, is that a counter argument, Jerome? Is that a counter argument to this? If our body is moved by our mind, what do we have to say here? We still have a case of one part that's moving the whole, right?
There are separate kinds, so each kind can't interact with the other.
Well, that was a big problem for modern philosophy in the 17th century. It's about how mind and matter interact. It's not a big problem for Aristotle, because mind isn't the same thing. It's not a separate entity. What is mind? It's a one sentence summary of the AI.
Sorry, it's the soul.
Well, okay, what is the soul? We did talk about this a little bit, didn't we? He says if a knife had a soul, what would the soul of the knife be? It's in the end of the hour. Yeah, which is cutting. Yeah. The soul of the knife would be cutting. Had a soul. If the eye had a soul, what would its soul be? Seeing. Now, you can't separate the seeing from the eye. You can't talk about the immortal seeing, like other human people do. There's no afterlife for the seeing of the eye. The seeing is the function of the eye. Right? It's the function of the matter. So it makes sense to talk about, it might make sense to talk about the soul moving body, maybe. If the soul is the functioning of the body. Don't be convinced too quickly, because it's not clear quite what to do with that here. It's going to come up again at the end of the next chapter. Okay. All right. So temporarily we're set here. According to this claim, according to the first claim, if it's the case that something is moving itself, it might be that one part of it is moving another part. And we can't, just because we don't know which part it is, we can't say that it's not the case that that's so. The next part of the argument is even sleazier than this part. You with me?
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, there's a part of the whole that's moving, and what is moving that part?
That's a good question.
It's regress back.
That's right. So what were we going to say? It's got to be something else.
I would suppose.
And then what are we going to say after that?
There's something moving that.
What?
That there was something moving that.
There's going to be something moving that. Where are we going to end up here?
Infinite regress.
If you have an infinite regress, nothing ever happens. So you have to go through an infinite number of steps before something happens. It never happens.
You end up to a first mover.
Yeah, you have to have a first mover. That's where we're heading here. Okay? You didn't peek ahead to the end of this. There's an argument for our first mover. That's what it's looking for. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, that works for a regress of external movers, but what about on the terms of this argument? I mean, we're going to keep dividing each. The part that's supposed to be responsible for the motion, it's going to be divided and part of it responsible for
it doesn't really make good sense here, but we're going to go, we need to look at the next part of the argument, because that's going to, I told you, it's even worse. So keep going. Somebody want to read the next part of the argument? We did first, right, now we're at second. I'm in the second place here, except that you're right at line 43. Right before 242.1. I don't know, he must have interchanged these. I'm not sure what's. I'm not sure why the numbers are. All right. Yeah. In second place, that which is in motion, without being moved by anything, does not necessarily cease from its motion because something else is at rest. But a thing must be moved by something if the fact of something else having ceased from its motion causes it to be at rest. A thing must be moved by something if the something's ceasing will cause it to be at rest. That's a very, very weak idea of being moved by something, right? Very weak criterion. Okay? I'm going to say it again. Something is moved by something else if the something else's being at rest will cause it to be at rest. Okay, so now we grab the same picture. If this is accepted, everything that is in motion must be moved by something. That's what we move on. Now, why is that? For if AB is assumed to be in motion, it must be divisible, since everything is in motion. We had this before. Earlier, we saw this in book 6, right? What?
I think it's the easiest sleeve.
This is the good part. Okay. If AB is in motion, it must be divisible. Everything that's in motion is divisible, right? Why? Because motion requires one part to acquire a character before another part. Otherwise, the motion is continuous. All right, it's got to be divisible infinitely. Since everything that is in motion is divisible, right? Let it be divided then at C. Now, if CB is not in motion, then AB will not be in motion. For if it is, it's clear that AC would be in motion while BC is at rest. And thus, AB cannot be in motion in its own right primarily. Didn't know that was an assumption, but it was. But X hypothesis, AB is in motion in its own right primarily. Therefore, if CB is not in motion, AB will be at rest. But we've agreed that that which is at rest, if something is not in motion, must be moved by something, right? That was that. Everybody accept this one. Consequently, everything that's in motion must be moved by something. For that which is in motion will always be divisible, and if part of it is not in motion, the whole must be at rest. All right. Did somebody translate that into English and tell me what the argument is?
So something is in motion. If the something else coming, being at rest, causes it to be at rest, then it's moved by something. That's the first thing.
Okay. Something is in motion. If something's being at rest will cause it to be at rest.
And we are assuming
something
that
is moved by something else. If that something else is being at rest will cause it to be at rest. That's what
we're
supposed
to be at. Okay. Right. And we're assuming that AB is in motion as it's its own principle of motion rather than being moved by something. That's what we're taking this stuff.
Let's assume AB is in motion by itself, of itself, primarily. X hypothesis. That's the assumption is AB is in motion all together, all at once. Now, AB is moving itself, it seems. And he's arguing against the idea that AB, against the claim that AB is moving itself, but actually it's being moved by something else. What's it being moved by? AC. AC, really, how is that? Because if AC were at rest, then AB would be at rest. How do we know that?
It's continuous. Continuous things move together.
Because it's moving primarily of itself, which is to say that all of it's moving together. And if it were the case that one part could be at rest and the other part not be at rest, then it wouldn't be moving by itself. Primarily, not altogether. So now what do we have? What? If this part were at rest, this part would also have to be at rest. Right? Because if this were at rest and this were in motion, then the whole thing wouldn't be moving primarily of itself. All right. We've already said that if one part being at rest would cause another part to be at rest, this part must move this part. Therefore, something is moving AB. It's AC. Well, let's have a little... Is everybody following the argument? Are you? Yeah. Question.
Would it not be considered AB moving itself then, if AC is moving AB?
We already said AB is moving itself. Right? Either it's moving itself or it's moved by another. What we want to show is that even things that move themselves are also moved by something. And the claim here is that any continuous thing is moved by any part of a continuous. Well, strange claim. Are you with me here?
Yeah. I'm still. Because AB isn't, then if it's continuous, AB isn't moved by AC, it's moved by the smallest, or it would have to be.
Well, AC could be anything.
Yeah.
It's just an arbitrary division. We know AB is divisible because it's in motion, and anything in motion is going to be divisible, right? So, okay, divide it someplace. Divide it at C. C could be any place. What happens if AC is at rest? Everything else is at rest. Why? Because we already said that it moves primarily of itself. Well, and that, that's to say, it moves as a continuous entity moves. And if it's, as he puts it, if it's accepted that something's being at rest would cause everything else to be at rest, then that something must be the cause of its motion. Pretty slimy, right?
Let's see.
I hope everybody is following the argument, right? Everybody, is the argument clear, everybody? Yeah, Dwayne, are you with me with this here? And are you? I hope that everybody is able to find it, see it in the text, because that's one of the reasons I'm going over this. Not just to show you that sometimes Aristotle's arguments are a little shaky, but to give you some practice in finding arguments in the text. Okay? Any more vision?
Still kind of wondering, because earlier we were saying that it doesn't really matter which one is moving which.
That's right. So there's something that's moving. Now, why would he talk about this? This is such a... It's obviously very important for him to show that everything that's in motion is moving by something. Because he's going to very great lengths to make this point. Why would it be important for him?
Because you have to show there is something except as a
It's part of an argument for a first clause. Somehow we have to get from here to a first clause. Okay, and part of the mode of getting to this first clause is going to be putting things into contact. The claim here is that, well, really, there's no problem in this case with something's moving itself. Why? Because any part could be moving the rest of it. They're in contact. It's always got to be the case that one thing is moved by another, and the things have to be in contact. So when we talk about a continuous thing, all right, one part's moving another. It's in contact with one part is in contact with all the other parts in a continuous thing.
No, it's because if there one part moves the whole thing, apparently it seems impossible. But was it able to have other entities?
Wait, why is it impossible?
Because, as we just said, the regression and the
that could be any part.
Yeah. And for something to move on itself, so Aristotle's not like the idea that something moves by say thermal energy or other kind of. Because something can move itself by using those kind of energy instead of being pushed by other locomotion.
We're going to talk about pushing and pulling and twirling soon.
Yeah.
But yeah. Now he's not saying how much motion it has. That's not relevant for the argument. Some things will move a lot by themselves. Some things will move just a little bit.
Because it's impossible.
It's impossible for there not to be something that's moving, even if it's moving by itself. Because one part will be in contact with the rest of it. Yeah?
How does this stand in relation to what we saw in book 6, that the parts aren't there until the the ratio become present and continuously,
right,
simultaneously without being in any one part. But here we're saying that the parts causing the rest of the motion. It seems like,
right, the part, whatever it is, whatever the part that we're talking about is something that either it's sort of like a leg and an arm, like it's there already, or it's a part that's arbitrarily lopped off. Could be either one. I don't think it's inconsistent with what we said before. Yeah.
Can we apply the exact same argument to the whole thing? So if AB stops, then AB will stop. Therefore, AB is keeping itself in motion.
Yeah, but that's, isn't that trivial?
What? How so?
AB is moving its own.
Right.
So something is moving its own.
Right. Which is contrary to what the goal is.
There are two possibilities. Either things move themselves or they're moved by something else. His claim is, if they're moved by something else, then it's obvious that there's something there to move them. His claim is, even when they're moved by themselves, there's still something there to move them.
Yeah, but that something, if that something is the whole,
yeah,
then that's no different from saying, yeah, it moves itself. Not part moving the rest, but the whole.
Yeah.
Since the if it stops argument works for the whole too.
I'm not sure how that would fit in with the rest of it. I don't know if there'd be any motive for it. It's already obvious that it moves as a whole. His claim is that somehow there has to be a part of it. And it doesn't seem, if you look at it, if you just read it without the rest of the context, it doesn't seem pretty complex. Unintelligible.
But it seems like in this case, motion would be in succession. And if it's in succession, then it wouldn't be moving continuously, it would be moving in parts.
Why is it in succession? Because what's succeeding what? I mean, A, C, and C, B are moving one after another. If the thing moves all together, they're gonna move all together.
But does one start to move before the other?
Not that I know of. That's why the argument is bizarre. He's talking about one thing moving the other, but there isn't any it's a continuous entity. It's not like there's motive power in one and not motive power in the other. So this is pretty strange stuff. Okay? So those of you who are reading this and are just completely convinced and have rejected Newtonian physics because of Aristotle and transformed your whole way of thinking, you should know that there are arguments here that are problematic, shall we say. Okay? Let's go on to the next one before we run out of time. He wants to show that there's a Lord. He wants to show that there's not an infinite sequence of causes. And he has an interesting way of doing it. What does he imagine here? We've got an A, B, and a C. A, B, C, and D. A is moved by B. B is moved by C. C is moved by D. Okay. Now what?
Now assume it's infinite.
Okay. Now what?
If you want A finish and then C in the finest time, I think.
Okay, good. Okay, so let's talk about the motion. What's the motion of A going to be?
He's saying that he's the motion.
What's that?
He's saying that he's the motion of A.
So we're going to move A in this direction. And it's B that moves A in this direction. What's B doing? Or small. Right? And C is causing B to, so what are we going to say about the motion of C? So now we have, what, an infinite number of things, each one caused to move, an infinite number of motions, and how long does this whole process take? Okay. Why is it finite? So each one of these things is actually moving a small distance. In the time that A moves from here to here, B moves from here to here, C moves from here to here, right? It's the same time that he calls it K. Right? So now we have an infinite number of things with an infinite motion in a finite time. Impossible. Not quite. It's got to add something to it. What's he have to add? We're on the next one, the last paragraph in chapter one. It might be thought that what we set out to prove has been shown. But our argument for it is important because it doesn't prove that anything is impossible results. For in a finite time, there may be an infinite motion, though not of one thing, but of many. What are we talking about here?
Not one change, but a bunch of changes.
They're all lots of things. There are an indefinite number of things. They're all moving. Think of the air molecules. They're all moving. We have an infinite number of things. In any one finite bit of time, there is an indefinite number of. There are an indefinite number of motions. There's an indefinite number of things that are in motion. No problem. Each thing accomplishes its own motion. There's no possibility of many things being in motion simultaneously. But what do we have to add here? Is that ready?
But it's impossible that one change should be
destroyed. In order for this to occur, there has to be some sort of context here, right? In order for one thing to move the other. And at the moment of contact, they form, as it were, one thing. If there are an infinite number of things that are all in contact, what we have is a thing, one thing, with an infinite magnitude. He's argued earlier in physics that there's no such thing. So this is a good argument. There cannot be an infinite number of causes, because an infinite number of causes would amount to a thing of infinite magnitude. Hey, that's pretty neat. Okay, everybody with me? Yes.
Do you think this is a problem, Plato?
Plato, why?
Because the world is one thing.
It's one thing, but it doesn't. In Plato, it's one. I don't know how to say this without giving the answer away here and spoiling all of the lead up here. If things are going to move in a circle, it's different. Okay. And that's what happens today. And also this is what happens here. All right, so we've now gone through the first chapter. Right? So now we're at the second chapter, which again starts. That which is the first mover of the thing is always together with that mover. Actually, it's an assumption that we just made in including this previous argument. So what we want to do is prove this assumption, which makes sense. Okay, great. We want to know is there can't be an infinite number of causes, right? There can't be, because they would form an infinite thing, as it were, because they have to be in contact. How do we all have to be in contact with each other? How do we do that? Give an argument about that. Great. So how many kinds of motion are there? Well, they're either three or four, right? Depends on, whether you count becoming. What's becoming? Becoming is change in the category of substance. So there's locomotion, change in place, which is one of the categories. Change in quality, change in quantity. So there are three kinds of motion and four kinds of change sometimes. All right, so he says, let's begin with locomotion. For this is the primary motion. And you already know why it's a primary motion, right? Because in order for one thing to be moved, it has to be moved by something that's in contact with it, and in order to get into contact, there has to be a local motion. So all motion, all change, all causation of one motion from, caused by another presupposes local motion. Great. Okay, what kind of local motions are there? Four kinds: pushing, pulling, carrying, and twirling. I don't know if anybody can think of some more here. Pushing, pulling, carrying, and twirling. All right. Pushing, they all turn out to be two. Why is that? What's carrying? Well, you're going to carry something, you're either going to be, what's the difference between pushing and pulling? You're going to be
pushing away from you or pulling
towards. That's it. Either the source is going to come, it's a little odd to talk about one thing pulling. I can understand a magnet pulling something in. But if it's already in contact, what are we talking about here? Pushing, pulling. I guess if it's sort of like, if I could get some glue put on here, and then I moved it away from the object, then it would be a pulling. And if I moved it towards the object, then it would be pushing.
I thought it was just away from its natural place.
Away from where?
Its natural place.
Oh, that's a good way to put it. Is that what he says? Pushing away from itself. I think it's away from itself. So pulling is when it's moving in a direction. It drags the other thing along with it. All right. Pushing, pulling. Carrying is either going to be a pushing or pulling that occurs while something else is attached. So carrying is going to reduce the pushing and pulling. And twirling? Twirling is it's going around in a circle, right? So it's a push and a pull. It's a pushing and a pulling. So, okay, back to pushing and pulling as the primary one. Now, what can we say about pushing and pulling? They only happen when something is together with something else. This is another pretty weak argument, because he's assuming the conclusion that he's trying to draw. I don't see anything here other than observations and a reduction of some motions to other motions. All right, and then he goes on to talk about the two more kinds of motions here. The next one is, actual alteration starts on the next page, 244B, around line 3. Alteration doesn't occur except by contact. And then he talks about growth and diminution. Well, growth is kind of easy, right? So how does something grow? You will grow faster by eating more. The cause of your increase in size is the bulk that you ingest. it's not possible to look for something to the brain. It's not possible to look at food and grow fatter. There has to be some congestion or some sort of contact. So that's pretty good. This one's pretty good. And in the case of alteration, it's also all right. Chapter 3 is interesting, but I'm going to. It's a more elaborate discussion of alteration. It claims everything, again, the assumption to be conclusions at the beginning, everything that undergoes alteration is altered by sensible causes. There's alteration only in things that are said to be affected in their own life by sensible things. That's not not obvious, I guess. And he works through a number of cases here which are interesting. The most interesting one of them is the last one, which I referred to a little while ago, about whether knowledge, acquiring knowledge, is an alteration, whether that involves an alteration. And he seems to say that it does not. The states of the intellectual part of the soul are not alterations, nor is there any becoming of them. Now, that's a little strange, because if you acquire knowledge, it looks like you have altered yourself. So I suggest here that the idea is that the states are fixed. It's you who undergoes the change when you acquire knowledge. It happens by some sort of an impact of a thing. You have to hear the voice or see the object. And you might say, well, wait a minute. If I see something, that's not contact. The tree's over there. There's no contact between me and the tree. I see it, right? Right. Okay. So in order for me to see it, there has to be light, and the light has to come from the tree, and it has to travel somehow through a medium. If there were a vacuum, the claim is if there were a vacuum, it wouldn't travel. Then I would be able to see it. Strange claim. Somewhat questionable by modern physics. If the light somehow is in contact with my eye, then I can see the object. If the sound travels from the object to my ear, then I can hear the sound, hear what is happening with the object. The claim is there has to be some sort of contact, even in sense organs. So one thing has to move another somehow. And then we get to this claim that in knowledge there is no alteration or change of, not even any becoming. That's a little bit weird, because it seems to go against the claim that every change is caused by something else, something after a contact. All right, so that for a second. Switch gears. Chapter 4. Come back to this. Maybe not. Chapter 4. What happens in chapter 4? Lots of very strange considerations here. Strange arguments. He's interested in commensurability. So, what is commensurability? And why is he talking about it? Is one motion commensurable with another? He's in particular concerned with whether linear motion is commensurable with circular motion. But in the course of this discussion, he mentions something else which is somewhat familiar to us.
Could motions be across gender?
Right. Right. So what are we doing with that? What's happening? Yeah, we're talking about motion, whether motion, one motion is comparable with another. Each motion belongs to a genus. So we somehow switch gears. How is it that we switch gears? in the previous chapters, the idea is that in order for a motion to occur, there has to be a contact between the mover and the mover, the mover and the mover. And that contact comes about through some sort of local motion. And that makes local motion primary for all the other motions, as we said. That means there's a kind of first motion, a kind of connection between the motion, and that connection is seemingly a kind of commensurability. The claim here is, even though each motion occurs because there's a mover and a moved, the motions themselves are not comparable. So even though we're talking about a cause of motion, and it would seem that one motion, only a motion of a similar sort could cause another motion to speak. But no. But, okay, so I'll put it positively. It's possible for the cause of motion to be a different sort of motion than the motion it causes. And that's actually a pretty dramatic claim for Aristotle, even though I can't quite make it as exciting at this point as I would like to. So I'll put it quickly and just in summary form here. In general, a form causes another form. Man is the cause of man, as he says. Okay? You have mosquitoes give rise to mosquitoes. Human beings give rise to other human beings. We also make other things, tables and chairs and artifacts, because they're in our minds and we can create something that's similar to what's in our mind. In general, the cause and the effect share in the form. So it's surprising, if it happens, if it works out, that there's something that doesn't have the form that is also a cause. As Aristotle says in the rest of the law, man is the cause of man, but also sun. Because without the circular orbit of the sun, there wouldn't be seasons. And without the seasons, there wouldn't be the plant and animal life that we have to sustain ourselves. So there are two kinds of causes at work. Form causes, form that gives rise to form, and this other type of cause that has something to do with local motion. Cause, one kind of cause, being caused by a like thing. Even though this second kind of cause is at work here and other places, it doesn't make the motions commensurable, which is problematic. How could one thing cause something else without it being commensurable? It's a minor version of problem that Duane mentions, which is a key modern problem for modern philosophy. How is it that mind causes matter to move? The two different kinds of things. Matter can cause matter. Mind can interact with mind, perhaps, but there isn't any way that a physical phenomenon could come about through something mental. That's the modern philosophical version of modern philosophical analog of the problem here, which is, how is it that one motion can come about from something that's not commensurable with that? All right, I'm going to stop. I'm going to say maybe a few more words about them. Seven, I'm going to say, but keep it short. The last chapter isn't terribly interesting, but we'll talk about it a little bit. And I will say something a little bit more about chapter three, which is, but let's go on to book eight and do the first chapter of book eight. We'll try to sift through. See you.